Welcome to Roots and Branches on VOA Music Mix. I'm Catherine Cole in Washington, and I'm very happy to welcome Tony Trischka to the Roots studio today. You may have heard me talking with Tony before. We've caught up with him at the International Bluegrass Music Association Conference, and I called him up to talk about Earl Scruggs and Pete Seeger when both of those legends passed away. But now it's time to put Tony on the spot and make him talk about himself and his music. He is a banjo innovator, one of the guys who took it out of bluegrass and folk music and into the jazz world and beyond. Tony came to D.C. to play in a concert at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, an annual show that honors Ralph Rinsler, one of the event's founders. This year, it was also a tribute to Tony's friend Pete Seeger. I do want you to play us one of Pete's songs at some point today, but you can start things off by playing anything you want. Trischka is finally, I mean, we've been talking about this for 20 years almost, finally here visiting with his banjo. For those that are not watching, just listening, that was a banjo. One man and his banjo is here visiting us today. The new CD is called Great Big World. What was the name of that track?
That was called Lost. And on the original track, there was a string trio, clarinet and flute. Abigail Washburn sang a vocal. Short vocal thing on that, but this was just the original solo banjo aspect of it.
Well, welcome to Washington. I guess we should start at the beginning. I mean, we've had you on the phone. We've talked to you in other places, but we haven't talked to you here.
In this very cozy, tiny little building.
Yeah, a little nutshell biography. You picked up the banjo first. How old were you?
I was 14. I heard a recording by the Kingston Trio called Charlie and the MTA, and there was a banjo solo on there, which changed my life, made me want to play the banjo.
What was it about that sound?
It's just this very, I sort of call it the magpie effect, all this bright, shiny stuff. And, oh, I'm going for that because it's fast and, you know, finger picks and metal on metal and just very exciting.
And so you picked it up and immediately could play? I mean, it's a kind of a hard instrument.
I struggled a little bit with that because I wanted to play bluegrass. I had that sound in my ear, but I didn't know where the notes were. Mm-hmm. And I had the Pete Seeger book, which many, many people have started off with and was a huge contributor to many banjo players. But there were only two bluegrass songs in there, and I couldn't quite get the hang of the tablature. And then I went to a hootenanny at Syracuse University. I grew up in Syracuse, New York. And there was this guy, there was folk singers, and there was a guy playing in a duo situation with a guitar player. He was a banjo player, and he was playing bluegrass, and it was, that's the sound. So I asked him if I could have lessons, and I took lessons. And the first lesson, he showed me a tune called Lonesome Road Blues, which I could play for you if I retune.
Okay.
And that was it. A lot of the vocabulary was in that one 30-second time through the tune, and that really opened the door. And then I took lessons for another, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 months, something like that.
Well, for people that are not that familiar with the banjo, what's the difference between a folk singer playing the banjo and a bluegrass person playing the banjo?
Well, if I can get in tune here.
Sure. Because that is important.
Change tuning, anyway, we'll put it that way. Well, I'm down here to honor Pete Seeger. We're doing something later this afternoon as this is being recorded. And Pete is sort of the paradigm of folk singers playing the banjo, of course. He would do things like that strumming kind of thing. And that's great. It's wonderful. It's just different. But it's not, doesn't necessarily take the dexterity of, you know, high-level Scruggs picking or something like that. Pete also was renowned for something called the basic strum.
Right.
Which is kind of like clawhammer style, old-time clawhammer style. And it's very effective for playing melodies, and it's not too hard. And that was the very first thing in Pete's banjo book, the basic strum.
I noticed you took the picks off your fingers
right
to play that, because when you're playing the banjo, sometimes you have these little picks that, not that you hold like a guitar player holds, but they're stuck onto your fingers.
They're these. They sound like this. Right. But when you do the basic strum, you have to strum down with the middle finger of the right hand, and the pick would come off. If you did that, or at least when I play, it would come off. So I take off the picks to do that. But in bluegrass, you wear picks because it's a lot louder and means that you can play more loudly than all the other instruments, which is why we play the banjo in the first place.
Well, I was about to say, a banjo is kind of loud to begin with.
Yes, not compared to bagpipes or a saxophone, but it is loud in the bluegrass end of things. So,
oh, yeah.
You have that much harder edge sound.
Play a little bit of bluegrass so people can now hear the difference between that folk style that you just played and a little bluegrass.
Okay, this will be a little bit of Lonesome Road Blues, which is the tune, very first tune I learned to play on the banjo. Something pretty close to this.
So then you took a couple of lessons and continued on after that and said, bluegrass is for me?
I started off again listening to the Kingston Trio, and their banjo player, Dave Gard, did this. And that's the solo that turned me onto the banjo. And then I was asking people, where can I hear more of this? And I said, well, listen to Earl Scruggs. And that's how I got into it. And through Earl Scruggs, I found out about Flatten Scruggs and about Bill Monroe and the Stanley Brothers and all the leading lights of bluegrass.
And that's kind of how a lot of people learn. I mean, they hear something that strikes their ear, and then they go backwards.
Sure.
And then backwards and backwards and backwards. Is that what you did when you found music? You just
continued? I don't know if it was backwards at that point, because that's what was happening at that. You know, Bill Monroe was still in his prime, and as were Flatten Scruggs and the Stanley Brothers and all that. But you're right. A lot of people got turned on to banjo by this. Bela Fleck, the very renowned banjo player, learned about bluegrass through that song. That's what turned him on to it.
We'll talk a little bit more about Bela and your connection with him in a while, but we're talking about you right now.
Right.
So was there a lot of banjo in Syracuse when you were a teenager?
I won't say there was a lot. There were a few people that played. There was one other, well, besides my teacher, who was at Syracuse University, there was another guy named Bill Hollowell who played three-finger style. And then there was, actually, I had an earlier teacher that was teaching me clawhammer, but I couldn't get the hang of it, and that's not the style I wanted to play in anyway. But it turned out he became the first person I started performing with, though, a guy named John Gaines back when. So there was some banjo playing around, but not a lot. But there was enough because there was this, my teacher could play all these different styles that were going on in bluegrass at that time and just opened the door immediately to all that stuff.
I'm Catherine Cole talking with Tony Trischka on Roots and Branches. Tony is telling us how he was introduced to the banjo and got started playing the five string. Let's hear something from his latest CD before we get back to talking. It's called Great Big World, a very appropriate title for a record that includes all kinds of music, not just the folk or bluegrass that comes to mind when you think of banjos. I think you might recognize this one. It is an old Woody Guthrie favorite, given a new lease on life by Tony Trischka.
Lots of folks back east, they say, is leaving home every day, leading the old hot dust away to the Californian line. Across the desert sands, they roll, heading out of that old dust bowl. Think they're going to Sugar Bowl, but here's what they find. The police at the point of entry say, you're number 14,000 for today. Oh, if you ain't got the do-re-mi, folks, you ain't got the do-re-mi. You better go back to beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee. California's a garden of Eden, a paradise to live in or see. Believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got that do-re-mi. Take a little vacation by the mountains or the sea. Don't sell your old house for a car. You better stay right where you are. Better take this little tip from me, 'cause I see it in the one as every day. The headlines on the papers always say, oh, if you ain't got that do-re-mi, folks, you ain't got that do-re-mi. Well, you better go back to beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee. California's a garden of Eden, a paradise to live in or see. Believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got that do-re-mi. Got that do-re-mi, folks. You ain't got that do-re-mi. Then you better go back to beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee. California is a garden of Eden, a paradise to live in or see. Believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got that do-re-mi.
Tony Trischka and Do Re Mi from Great Big World on Roots and Branches. Okay, let's pick up the story when you first started playing in a band.
I was in high school at that point, met some people that were in college, and I started playing with them. I became their banjo player, and we had a group called the Down City Ramblers, and I started playing locally and played at Captain Mac's Clam Shack in Syracuse. And I remember playing one time, and I felt like my banjo was exploding, and someone had thrown a clam shell and hit the bridge and went, bam, you know. That was one of the more frightening moments of my life. And so I was, you know, 15, 16 years old, completely underage, playing in this bar. with these college guys. And then we started a group called the Down City Ramblers, like I say, and we went to the very first Bluegrass Festival in 1965 in Fincastle, Virginia, and drove all night, and ended up in Fincastle, Virginia, and there's Bill Monroe, and there are the Stanley Brothers, and there's Jimmy Martin and Mac Wiseman, and everybody was there. All the leading lights, they're just walking around. And David Grisman was there. Ralph Rinsler, in whose name we're doing this thing this afternoon, was down there also. So just a whole host of people from the north, the south, hippies, maybe pre-hippies, lawyers, farmers, just all walks of life brought together in this little festival.
What was that mix like? I mean,
we were all there for the music. I mean, we were coming from different worlds. Mm-hmm. And, of course, these days those worlds have blended and, you know, homogenized. But in those days, you know, especially, let's say, going on a little bit to 68, 69, when people, you know, people would have hair to their shoulders, mm-hmm. as I did at the time in 1970, around that time, and then you'd meet these guys. I remember going to a parking lot with a friend of mine who was looking to buy a guitar from these, you know, really countryish guys who were not into the long hair thing at all, and they had like buzz cuts, and we had hair to our shoulders, and there was that quote redneck quote hippie disparity, but you know, it felt a little hairy, mm-hmm. but you know, we all got along, and we're all here for the music. So,
right, because it was traditionally a very conservative type of music.
Well, initially, yeah. I mean, there were firebrands. Mm-hmm. The Country Gentlemen, for instance, would do things
from Washington,
right here in D.C.
Yeah.
And they would do like the theme from Exodus, mm-hmm. or Big Bad Bruce. John Duffy would sing that. And they were probably the first group that really kind of stretched some of those boundaries, in my mind. You know, Jim and Jesse would do some stuff that was, they did a Chuck Berry album, for instance, in the 60s, an album of all Chuck Berry songs. But they were considered more traditional. So, there were always people pushing against the limits a little bit. Don Reno would. Earl Scruggs, I mean, Bill Monroe invented bluegrass, but that didn't exist. And he was playing swing music in the 40s. You listen to the pre-Flat and Scruggs band, he's got walking bass, offbeat guitar, accordion. Sally Forrester, who was playing accordion,
yeah.
Who Sam Bush told me the story how he met Sally Forrester at some point in Nashville, you know, maybe 10 years ago or something. And Sally Forrester, what a great honor to meet you. And she said, you know, she's played in the original Columbia recordings by Bill Monroe. And she said, oh, well, my name's really Wilhelmina. They called me Billy, but Bill Monroe didn't want to have two Bills in the band, so he called me, I'm going to call you Sally Forrester. Sally Ann Forrester, which is the name of a fiddle tune, so she became Sally Forrester. Little bluegrass obscurity.
So what was it like seeing Earl Scruggs the first time?
I saw him in 1963 at Cornell University. It was just a thrill beyond thrills. And I remember after we left, we saw their bus at truck stop or something going out of town, and I found a recording of that exact show, and they sounded great. And little did I know that many years later I'd actually get to record with him and get friendly with him. You know, it's like in those days he was a god who walked the earth.
Did you start writing music then, or did that seem like something other people did?
Well, you know, it's interesting because pre-banjo I got into folk guitar, the Weavers, mm-hmm. and Pete Seeger and Bob Dylan and Tom Paxton and Phil Oakes and all those sorts of folks. And I got very socially conscious, you know, about the whole civil rights thing. And I started writing civil rights songs, actually. These four girls that were killed in the church down, mm-hmm. south in Birmingham, I think it was. And I wrote a song about them because that's what was going on. So I was writing protest songs, basically, in like 62 or when that was all happening. And then I lost my social consciousness when I started playing the banjo. I just became a banjo player. So that early on, I was writing some songs. I wrote a song about the Panama Canal. It's all very obscure stuff. And I'd say maybe around 65 or 66, I started writing some songs, one of which was called The Theme from Godzilla. And I sent it to Bill Keith, this amazing banjo player who played with Bill Monroe in 1963. I sent him a tape of like four songs, which you tried to find not that long ago and couldn't, unfortunately. I'd like to hear what they sounded like.
And were you convinced at that time that banjo was going to be your life then, or were you still toying with the idea of a real job?
No, I mean, I never thought about it. You know, mm-hmm. people say, like, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like in college, people are in their senior year. I don't know what I'm going to do. I just don't have any drive, ambition in any direction. I was just playing the banjo. I was a fine arts major, so mm-hmm. I could have been a curator at a museum or written for an art magazine, who knows, or worked at the Hirshhorn, who knows. And instead, I just was playing the banjo. And I just kept playing the banjo once I got out of college. It was never, I never thought, what am I going to do? I just always did it and continued to do it. So that was my passion.
So you're not surprised to find yourself today
still playing the banjo. I'm thinking of making a career change. I'm going into shoes, actually.
Right.
I'd like to announce it on your show.
Well, before you do that, let's have another song.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That sounds good. I'll do an Earl Scruggs medley. How about that?
Okay.
Starting with Nashville Skyline Rag. Bob Dylan tune that Earl Scruggs made safe for the banjo. And then a little bit of Ground Speed, which is one of Earl's tunes, wonderful tune. And finish off with a little bit of Shuckin' the Corn.
Earl Scruggs medley, I don't know what else to call it, from Tony Trischka. Tell us a little bit about that banjo that you're playing before we get along. It's beautiful.
This is a banjo made in the Czech Republic, where there's a lot of banjo music, and even during communist times, had maybe even more so during those years. And it was made by a guy named Zdeněk Roh. And my background is Czech on my father's side, and I really identify with it and have had the opportunity to tour over there a couple of times when it was still communist and then a number of times afterwards. This guy said, hey, would you like me to make you a banjo? And I said, yeah, because he made really nice banjos. And I said, sure. And here, take a look at this. Oh, no, they can't see.
Some people can see.
Some people can see, but there's some nice quilted maple on the back, which is almost like a hologram. You can almost go swimming in there. So deep. The inlay, I wanted the inlay to be based on the designs of a guy named Alphonse Mucha, who was probably the most renowned Art Nouveau artist from Czechoslovakia. He painted from the 1890s into the 1930s. And so he said, okay, fine. He sent me pictures of this banjo and with this beautiful inlay pattern. And when I got over there to take a look at it and pick it up and play it, I said, so who did the inlay pattern? And it turned out that Mucha's granddaughter designed it. Huh. So there's a direct connection to this artist. She did a beautiful, beautiful job of it. So.
It's spectacular.
I think so.
We're talking today with Tony Trischka. His newest CD is called Great Big World. We'll hear more music from that one in just a bit. I'm Catherine Cole. This is Roots and Branches on the VOA Music Mix Network.
Thank you.
Hello again from Washington. I'm Catherine Cole. This is Roots and Branches on VOA Music Mix. Tony Trischka is visiting us today with his banjo in hand. He came to D.C. to perform at the annual Smithsonian Folklife Festival, playing in the Ralph Rinzler Memorial Concert, which this year was dedicated to the memory of Pete Seeger, who passed away last January, just a few months before he would have turned 95. Now, you know that I don't usually make requests, but I did ask Tony to play one of Pete's songs for us.
I'm going to play a song called Blue Skies, which is something he recorded in 1955 on his Goofing Off Suite album. It's a great, great album, which I didn't have till years later. And everyone thinks about Pete as just kind of strumming and doing the basic strum kind of a thing. But what he did in 1955 on this recording is remarkable. It was so far ahead of its time technologically. And people don't think of Pete as being a technical banjo player, but he was a great banjo player.
It's interesting to me, a lot of times here in advertising and stuff, when people want to do something all-American, they show a picture of a banjo. But we know that a banjo is really not an all-American instrument. It's not something that was born here.
The banjo, the antecedents are Africa, West Africa, and there are instruments over there called bonzas. They've got other names, a conting, and it's a gourd instrument made from a gourd. With a neck, usually fretless, with strings on it. And that was the original banjo, if you want to call it that. And when the Africans were brought as slaves to the Americas in the 1620s, I want to say, initially, they sometimes would recreate them on these shores, but on some occasions they would be allowed to bring their instruments with them so that the slaves could be exercised on deck, so that they would survive that middle passage. Which is, a horrible history for the instrument, and if they weren't, they'd be flogged. So it's got a very checkered history in that sense. So this was going on up until around the 1830s. And in the 1830s, a gentleman named Joel Walker Sweeney, who lived in Appomattox, Virginia, was listening to the music of the Africans and African-Americans around him, the slaves in his area, and he loved their music, he loved the dances, he loved their bonza, or merriwang, as it was called, this African banjo, if you want to call it that. And so he decided to make his own. So he got a gourd, fashioned a crude neck, and yanked some hair from the family horse's mane and twined it together with beeswax, used that for the strings, and killed the family cat for the head. And his mother was not too pleased about this, so she destroyed his rudimentary bonza. And so he made a second one, killed the second family cat, and she felt like the feline mortality rate was getting a little out of hand, so let him become a banjo player. Which he did, and he started one of the very first minstrel shows, went to England, played for Queen Victoria, and he's credited with adding the fifth string to the banjo, because this is a five-string banjo that I play. But the banjo already had the short string on the side, and that was an African invention, if you will. And if anything, Joel Sweeney added the low fourth string.
Okay.
That. But it was right around, somewhere around the 1840s, that a guy named Boucher, who was a drum maker in Maryland, in Baltimore, started doing the drum construction. He was a drum maker. And so, hey, let's take this neck and throw it on a drum. And that's how it started. I've heard that Joel Sweeney was maybe involved with that process. So the banjo, as we know it today, with the drum construction for the pot, with a five-string neck, started back in the 1840s.
And you've done a whole show around that history of the banjo, haven't you?
Yeah, there's a show called World Turning. It was an album on Rounder Records, and then I decided, hey, I'll do a show about this. And I got a woman who would narrate. And I collected texts from various times in banjo's history and put the show together.
And what was the reaction to that? I mean, people seem surprised to learn that the banjo had a history before bluegrass.
Yeah.
Folk music.
Yeah, exactly. People liked it. You know, I do these shows and people say, you know, it was so educational. You know, what are you doing on, you know, and I'd sort of joke about it. What are you doing on a Saturday night? You're going to a banjo history show. Woo! What an exciting life you lead. But people would say they really enjoyed it. You know, they didn't realize how much they'd enjoy the educational aspect of it. But I would have people coming up, right after the show saying, really like that. I didn't know that.
Despite the fact I learned something.
Exactly.
I didn't want to.
Exactly.
Well, let's have another song, if we could.
Okay. Let's see. Maybe I'll do that Earl Scruggs song I was talking about.
Sure.
This is a tune called Brown's Ferry Blues. And I was producing Steve Martin's second album called Rare Bird Alert, and he was playing out in Missouri near Branson, not in Branson, but near Branson, doing an outdoor show with Earl Scruggs. And so I was backstage talking to Steve and the band, and then Earl Scruggs' road manager came over and said, would you like to play the banjo? And I went, yeah. So went over to Earl's dressing room, and I was already friendly with Earl before that, and there's Earl with the banjo in his lap, and he hands me his banjo. And I played on it a little bit, and then Steve Martin was back there, and I handed him the banjo, and he put it in this so-called double C tuning. And then Steve handed it back to Earl, and Earl just started playing this tune called Brown's Ferry Blues. Geeky banjo player, anytime you hear Earl Scruggs, would hear Earl Scruggs do a new tune that had never been recorded, you're just like, oh, I gotta learn this right now. And he just offhandedly played this. And I've never heard him play in this tuning before. And he just picked up and started playing this Brown's Ferry Blues, which he never recorded and never heard it played in a live show, anything. He just had this tune in him. And he's sitting there playing, and I'm standing there, where's my iPhone? I gotta record this, you know. It's like, that was, and I couldn't. So this is not exactly what he played, but this first part, I remember that he did play that, you know. So it's close to what he did.
That's pretty cool. So then every time you were near him after that, did you try to get him to play it again?
I would go to shows, and what would happen is he played at a place called B.B. King's a couple of times in New York City, and I would go, you know, see the show and then go to say hello afterwards, and his son Gary Scruggs, who was playing bass with him, and Gary would be the one to get paid. So he said, why don't you go hang out with Dad, in the back room, in the dressing room, while I go get paid. And I'd hang out there with Earl for like 20 minutes to half an hour. And Earl was not a really effusive, great conversationalist, but we would talk, and I'd ask him about the old days, and he would tell me stories like when they did this show called Petticoat Junction, which was one of the great it's part of our great cultural heritage, really, if you think about it. Because Flatt and Scruggs used to be on the Beverly Hillbillies, and Paul Henning was the producer or director of that show, and he also was about to start doing Petticoat Junction. And he asked Earl if Earl would be the engineer on Petticoat Junction. And Earl said, well, it would break up Flat and Scruggs. And he's, and Paul Henning said, well, we'll fly you back and forth to the Opry from Hollywood every Saturday night. And he decided not to do it. So Banjo History would have taken a completely different course. So anyway, that's an obscure story that Earl just happened to mention in this conversation I was having with him. To answer your question, he didn't. His banjo was in some other room, so it wasn't like he had his banjo out. Right. I said, how could you play that again? I wish I could. I've had a chance to do that with Pete Seeger, but not with Earl.
You mentioned Steve Martin.
Yeah.
People seem to forget that he's a great banjo player. I mean, did for many years and seem surprised by that fact. Yet all they would have had to do was take one look at his biography and realize he's been playing the banjo almost as long as he's been writing jokes.
Longer, really. He started in high school.
Yeah.
And a guy named John McEwen gave him banjo lessons. John McEwen was with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band for many, many years. Anyway, so he just started. He would say how he would just, because his parents didn't want him to be playing in the house, and he would go sit out in the family car in the driveway in L.A. in 100-degree heat with the windows closed playing the banjo. So, you know, he must have lost 20 pounds doing that.
But that's dedication.
That's dedication. So he was seriously into it. And I was playing with a band called Breakfast Special in 1974 in New York City, and I remember we did this show. We played a four-night stand. And we were the main act, but they put this group called the Buckingham Nicks in front of us for the first two nights, which was Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks. And then the second two nights, our opening act was Steve Martin, who had the arrow through the head and the balloon animals and was playing banjo. And I remember talking to him a little bit then. So I always like to compare our career trajectories from then, you know. Anyway, so that's when I first met him. And he was playing banjo as part of his show. And, you know, people remember his comedy routines. He was playing banjo.
I remember seeing him do shows around that time with the banjo.
And he did a lot. I mean, he would get up and play solo, you know, do his comedy act in front of 20,000 people. And he'd play a little bit of Foggy Mountain Breakdown or whatever. And he just kept playing it. So I asked him to be on an album I recorded called Double Banjo Bluegrass Spectacular for Rounder Records maybe 7 years ago or something like that. And we decided to do two songs, one of which was a song called The Crow, and which is a tune that he wrote. And so that was around the time he started getting back into it because, you know, he's got to play one of his tunes. And, you know, when I started saying, hey, you should do your own album. I'm not trying to take credit for anything really, but just, and he started writing some new tunes. And then, of course, his career these days, he's given up movies and he's playing the banjo. Because going to the money is really what he's all about, after all.
Right, and there is so much money. But it's interesting because there are a lot of people looking at the banjo slightly differently because he is spending so much time on the road leading a band with a banjo.
Exactly. And that's, I know that's turning on people because I have this instructional website and people write in. Yeah, there's a little note for each student's page and they say, how did you get into the banjo? Well, Steve Martin. And a lot of people, he's going around and turning on a lot of people. There's sort of the big bang of Foggy Mountain Breakdown from Bonnie and Clyde that turned a lot of people on, or the Beverly Hillbillies, or Dueling Banjos, which is like one song that everyone got turned on to, and I got to play the banjo. But Steve is sort of that long haul, he's just out there touring all the time, a lot, and people get to hear him play the banjo. And plus he has this Steve Martin Award for Excellence in Banjo and Bluegrass that's given out every year, which is a high-profile thing that goes so far all the banjo players. It's a $50,000 award, and he goes on Letterman, and the banjo player gets on Letterman, and it's just, he's done a lot for the banjo.
And it's nice, and it gives those people a little cushion so they can spend their time doing something and not worrying, I mean, doing something banjo-related and not worrying where the next dollar is going to come from.
Exactly. That's the whole purpose of it. Exactly.
And you mentioned Bela Fleck earlier. Now, we think of Bela now as a band leader or a sideman, and, you know, he just finished the concerto that he was writing.
Right.
When you met him, he was just a kid who wanted to learn how to play the banjo.
Right. I got a call 73 or thereabouts, 1973, from a 16-year-old kid named Bela Fleck. That's an interesting name. And he showed up at my apartment in the Bronx. I was living about a half a block from Yankee Stadium at the time. And he takes out his banjo and he was good. He was playing fiddle tunes and playing some Earl Scruggs things. But he was just getting into, he'd bought my first album called Bluegrass Light, which was on Rounder. And he just wanted to learn those tunes. And there were some weird tunes on there. So
where better to go than the inspiration?
And he had been taking lessons from someone else who Bailey told his other teacher, Mark Horowitz, well, I want to learn these tunes by Tony Trischka. And so Mark would have to laboriously learn these weird tunes that I was writing every week, you know, for a few weeks. And he said, why don't you just take lessons from Tony? He lives in New York. And so he started taking lessons from me. And, you know, within a few months, I mean, it was very obvious that this guy was going to go all the way. Mm-hmm. He just had it.
So you were not surprised in the least to see what he's doing now?
No. I mean, I was very irresponsible as a teacher because he wanted to learn all this weird stuff. And I would improvise off a traditional tune and go crazy on it and all sorts of weird stuff. And then he would come back. I'd play for like 3 or 4 minutes. And then he'd record it and then come back the next week having transcribed the entire thing perfectly.
Well, you know, we've neglected your new album.
Why let's not neglect that.
No. Tell me a little bit. You've got a boatload of special guests on this one. I see a hearkening back to Woody Guthrie, among other people, mm-hmm. on this. A couple of new original songs. Is this just a bringing together of old friends?
It's a vanity project, really. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's,
aren't they all?
They're all vanity projects, exactly. This is kind of hearkening back to my very first albums where Rounder mm-hmm. Records would just let me do what I wanted to do. I had some original tunes. I want to record them. Okay, here, go. Mm-hmm. And that was like in the early 70s. So whereas since then I had a double banjo album. That was a kind of a concept thing. And then I had the world-turning banjo history thing. I did a duet album with Bela Fleck called Solo Banjo Works, even though we're two of us.
Right. A great Christmas album that
and
we
the Christmas
tried
album.
Out every year.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. But I hadn't done a sort of random, just tunes I'd written album in a long time. So this is what this is. I had another album project in mind, but Rounder thought this would be a better thing. And hey, I get to just do what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And they said, just do that, but have two or three songs that are bluegrass. That's all we ask. They said two songs. I went, okay, I can do that. So I took Woody Guthrie's Do Re Mi and made it a bluegrass song because I've been friendly with Nora Guthrie, Woody's daughter, mm-hmm. and we'd done some shows honoring Woody. And then another one called Wonder Where You Are Tonight, an obscure version taken from Bill Monroe's, an acetate of Bill Monroe playing on the Opry in 1942 that's got some extra beats in it. It's a little weird, mm-hmm. and that's how Bill did it back then, so I decided to do that. Those are the bluegrass things, and the others are just tunes that I'd written. So I've written most of the tunes on here, and a departure for this album is that I've written a lot of lyrics for it also, because maybe every other album I would write lyrics to a song, but this has, I don't know, 6 or 7 tunes with lyrics on it.
I see your son is on this one.
Exactly. My son's on the first tune, which is called Say Goodbye, which I wrote because Rounder had said we want a couple of bluegrass tunes, and then when the whole album was recorded, they said, well, let's have the first song on the album be one of the bluegrass tunes. And they hadn't told me that before, and neither of them really felt like boffo kick off an album kind of a tune. So I wrote the song Say Goodbye, which is a more up-tempo song. And I was trying to think of a mandolin player, and my son lives in our house, or at the time was, and played mandolin. Oh, maybe I could use him. And he's a drummer and has a great sense of time. So anyway, I'm just kidding around, but I had my son playing mandolin on that.
Was it a shock to have a child that wanted to get in the family business?
I won't say I was a shock. I think very early on, he took piano. We had him taking piano lessons when he was 6 or 7 years old. And his teacher had him playing, I'm a little raindrop falling from the sky, you know, songs like that. And he was like bored to tears. And he said, Dad, teach me how to play Hey Bulldog, this somewhat obscure Beatles tune, mm-hmm. which has a kickoff on keyboard going dun 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 dun. It's a pretty syncopated thing for a kid who's 6 or 7 years old. So I listened to the recording and figured out how to play it on the piano. It wasn't that difficult. And I showed it to him, and he nailed it, the whole syncopation. And I said to his piano teacher, why don't you just have him play Beatles tunes? Can you teach him some Beatles tunes? Because he loves the Beatles. And she did. So even early that early on, there was a sense. And he was just he loved music and listened to it all the time and became impassioned by it and started playing drums. And we bought him a snare drum to begin with. And then he was gone from there.
And he's studying music now?
He's at the Berklee College of Music.
So that means he's in for the long haul.
He's probably in for the long haul, I imagine.
I'm Catherine Cole, along with Tony Trischka on Roots and Branches. Tony was just talking about his son Sean playing on Say Goodbye, the opening track to Tony's new Great Big World CD, and I can't think of a better intro for it, can you? Chris Eldridge is the one singing lead and playing guitar in this song.
Clouds are
Tony Trischka is my guest in the Roots studio this week, and I want you to come back anytime. But before you go, can you play us one more song?
This is a medley of three tunes, one which I wrote for my lovely wife, Asunta, called 18. It was for our 18th wedding anniversary. And then the second and third tunes are on the new album, and the second tune is called A Belated Wedding Hoedown, which I wrote for Steve and his wife, Anne, for their wedding after the fact, thus the title. And then the last tune is Stephen Foster's Angelina Baker. Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the program this week and my visit with Tony Trischka. I look forward to your comments. The email address is roots@voa.gov. That is roots@voa.gov. I'm Catherine Cole. This is Roots and Branches on the VOA Music Mix Network.